Hello, I'm your reader, Lisa Horsch, and it's time for our birthdays. Michael Sullivan of Waterloo, happy birthday, Michael. Charles Eldridge of Windsor Heights, happy birthday to you, Charles. And Marion Brown of Washington, happy birthday, Marion. If today is your birthday and you didn't hear your name, give us a call so we can be sure to get your birthday on our list. Let's get back to the news with our first story from the USA Today in the Surfside disaster. Biden to visit condo ruin. Toiling in heat, workers struggle to find victims. This is written by Kevin McCoy and Trevor Hughes. Emergency crews at the site of a collapsed South Florida condo aren't just battling summer weather, smoldering fire, and dangerous debris in their race to find nearly 150 unaccounted for victims. They're fighting time, heat, water, and other factors that will make it harder to identify the dead. The longer the search takes, the more likely it is that bodies and human remains will have decomposed significantly. That will make it harder to recover DNA to identify the victims, forensics experts say. On Tuesday, searchers completed the sixth day of painstaking work since the collapse. Officials say they consider it a rescue mission, not a recovery. However, no one has been found alive since Thursday amid the piles of broken and pulverized concrete, twisted metal, and dangling debris. Considering the conditions at the Florida collapse and the time that's elapsed, this really does come down to DNA analysis, said Victor Whedon, Maryland's chief medical examiner and a DNA expert on the faculty of George Washington University's Department of Forensic Science. Forensic experts say DNA identification will take weeks, if not longer, but it probably won't take as long as past mass casualty events. That's partly because of advances in technology spurred by the 9/11 terrorist attack that destroyed the World Trade Center and prompted a victim identification effort that continues today. It's been a fruitful 20 years in terms of DNA technology advances, said Tracy Dawson Green, a professor and chair of Virginia Commonwealth University's Department of Forensic Science. Now, just a few cells of DNA are enough to do an identification. Challenge of identifying victims. It's difficult to identify victims in a mass casualty event like the collapse of the Champlain Towers South condominium in Surfside, Florida. Investigators first look for clothing that family members would recognize. They also check for IDs in victims' pockets or purses. However, most residents were asleep when the 12-story building collapsed shortly after midnight Thursday morning. They may not have been wearing easily identified clothing and may not have had their driver's licenses. The bodies of many victims may have been crushed or badly broken by the collapse, making easy identification impossible. The next option for investigators to look for is teeth and dental work, which can be compared with dental x-rays. They look for signs of medical implants that might have identification numbers and check fingerprints against official records. However, the force of tons of rubble may have pulverized jawbones and teeth. Exposure to South Florida's heat, humidity, and rainfall, plus a smoldering fire and water and other liquids in the rubble may have obliterated fingerprints, Whedon said. Those conditions have made the work slow. The time that it takes is just so painful, and that's why this matters, said Julie French, a former DNA scientist with the Michigan State Police. This brings closure to the families that are grieving as fast as possible. How investigators will use DNA. DNA identification involves comparing a DNA sample from bodies or body parts to samples such as those provided by close relatives, like siblings, parents, and children, plus tests of the utensils that have been used by the victims. Florida investigators began swabbing the cheeks of anxious relatives not long after the collapse. However, it's not always possible to extract DNA. Body fragments may not have enough DNA to check for matches, and DNA degrades from exposure to heat, water, and other elements. Moreover, DNA identification is complicated when body fragments of multiple victims may be mixed together in the rubble. The longer the rescue and recovery effort, goes, the more difficult identification will be simply because of decomposition, said Dr. Anthony Falsetti, a forensic anthropologist at George Mason University's College of Science. He worked on several major mass casualty events, including the 9/11 World Trade Center collapse and the 1995 truck bombing of the Alfred P. Murrah Building in Oklahoma City. Some 9/11 victims were never ID'd. After the 9/11 terror attack, the Office of Chief Medical Examiner of the City of New York led a massive effort to identify each of the 2,753 people killed in the collapse of the Twin Towers. Today, slightly more than 1,000 haven't been identified by DNA, in part because the fires sparked by the collisions of the passenger jets and fires from jet fuel obliterated all traces. However, that identification work never stopped. In July of 2018, nearly 17 years after 9/11, the medical examiner's office announced that advanced DNA testing had identified a 1,642nd victim, Scott Michael Johns, 26, a financial worker. Previous efforts to get sufficient DNA from a body fragment had failed, but new analysis techniques used by the New York City forensic investigators and similar labs across the country have turned such failures into successes. Mark Wilson, a 16-year veteran of DNA work and other lab analysis for the FBI, who's now an assistant professor at George Mason University's College of Science, explained the process. First, part of a bone fragment, often from the femur, is pulverized to a fine powder, which makes extraction of DNA easier. Demineralization removes non-DNA material. After a few additional steps, investigators conduct amplification procedures on the DNA, readying it for comparison from known samples from victims' relatives or investigative databases. The advanced techniques have brought some time, or bought some time, for investigators of the Surfside collapse and other mass casualties, said Dawson Green, the Virginia Commonwealth University Forensic Science Department chair. The DNA community as a whole has gained a lot more experience, she said. We can do things that we weren't able to do before. The photograph accompanying this article has a caption that reads, "Searchers dig through the rubble Tuesday at the base of Champlain Tower South Condominium in Surfside, Florida." And it shows a very small picture of a pile of debris with over a dozen searchers all wearing helmets and protective gear on that rubble. Kyle Bagenstos and Romina Ruiz-Gorina write, "Concrete deterioration in doomed tower was accelerating in April." A letter sent in April from the president of the Champlain Tower South Condominium Association said that damage to the doomed building's basement garage had gotten significantly worse since an inspection about 2.5 years earlier, and that deterioration of the building's concrete was accelerating. The letter suggested that millions of dollars in needed repairs had been a subject of frustration among residents. The letter offers a glimpse into the events leading up to the building's collapse last week in Surfside, Florida, that left 11 people dead and 150 missing. "We have discussed, debated, and argued for years now, and will continue to do so for years to come as different items come into play," the letter said. The April 9th letter was obtained by USA Today from a family member of two missing residents of the building. The author, Jean Woodnicki, the president of the association's board of directors, survived Thursday's collapse, a condo association attorney said. Over 7 pages, Wadnicki provided an overview of the major repairs required for the building. She noted that in fall of 2018, as documents released by the town of Surfside show, the association hired engineering firm Morabito Consultants to inspect the building. That inspection found a major error in the design of the building, crumbling concrete columns in the garage area beneath the structure, and predicted that failure to fix the problems in the near future will cause the extent of the concrete deterioration to expand exponentially. In her letter written about 30 months later, Wadnicki reported that the observable damage, such as in the garage, has gotten significantly worse since the first inspection. "When you can visually see the concrete spalling, cracking, that means that the rebar holding it together is rusting and deteriorating beneath the surface," she told residents. Jay Miller, a retired college professor from Philadelphia, who moved to Champlain Towers South 3 years ago, told USA Today on Saturday residents knew about a report in October of 2018 that warned of major structural damage and voted to make fixes, though reaching that agreement took time. "It wasn't like people were ignoring it," Miller said. "When residents discussed the report in 2018, the $7 million price tag led to turmoil on the condo's association board, Miller recalled. A new board of extremely dedicated and conscientious people took over, Miller said, but they'd lost about a year in dealing with the damage warned about in the report. Marta Castro, a resident of Champlain East Tower, said she routinely talked to people in the South Tower who voiced concerns. They had been talking about it for quite a while. She said the few I talked to were concerned about the financial aspects of it. Castro, a former Homeowners Association board member in Champlain Tower East, said the South Tower always seemed in disarray, in need of a fresh paint job and littered with concrete chips. She said she was friends with several people in the collapsed tower who are missing. As far as she knew, the South Tower's condo association was competent, she said, but she's angry that a lapse in oversight would allow the building to reach such a decrepit state. My time of mourning lasted 3 days, she said. Now I'm enraged. Woodnicki's Leather said the condition of the building's roof had become much worse and required additional repairs. She noted that cost estimates increase every year and that the estimated bill for all repairs had increased to $16.2 million this year. The letter said the association could repurpose $707,003 in other dedicated funds to the project, but that would leave a bill of $15.5 million. A big, big chunk of that was the structural stuff that needed to be done, Miller said. I don't remember anybody saying we shouldn't do the concrete work. I think everybody agreed on that. Woodnicki said repairs to the basement's pool deck area, which engineer Frank Morabito said had been designed on a level surface instead of sloped appropriately to run off water, would be expensive. Because so much of the needed concrete waterproofing work is underground, we must pull up almost the entire ground level of the lot to access the areas that require repair, Woodnicki wrote. She cautioned that when performing any concrete restoration work, it is impossible to know the extent of the damage to the underlying rebar until the concrete is opened up. Oftentimes, the damage is more extensive than can be determined by inspection of the surface, she said. Woodnicki concluded that she hoped the letter would help some residents who believed we are assessing too much to better understand why a coming assessment would be so costly. Your board of directors is working very hard to bring this project to fruition, consulting with engineers, accountants, and attorneys, she wrote. We have covered so much ground already to get the project rolling. 75 days later, the building collapsed. Savannah Berman and Ledger King writing for the USA Today, bill would strip Capitol of statues from Confederacy. House votes 285 to 120 to remove figures from statuary hall. The House of Representatives passed a bill Tuesday that would remove Confederate statues from the U.S. Capitol, as well as a bust of the former Supreme Court Chief Justice who wrote the 1857 Dred Scott decision that denied enslaved people the right to be citizens. This sacred space, this temple of democracy, has been defiled for too long. We ought not to forget history. We must learn from history, but we ought not to honor that which defies the principles for which we stand, House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer, a Democrat from Maryland, said on the House floor. It's time to remove those symbols of slavery, segregation, and sedition from these halls. The bill passed by a vote of 285 to 120. Every Democrat and 67 Republicans voted for it. The bill would need 10 Republican senators to join every Democrat to pass the upper chamber. The legislation would require states to remove and replace any statues honoring members of the Confederacy and the National Statuary Hall collection in the Capitol. Though a number of Republicans supported the bill, they used the debate to point out Democrats representing the South during the Civil War and the era of Jim Crow. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, Democrat from California, criticized Democrats as hypocrites on race. The Democratic Party has doubled down on what I consider this shameful history by replacing the racism of the past with the racism of the critical race theory, he said, referring to the academic examination of systemic racism in American life. The House passed similar legislation last year, but it stalled in the Republican-controlled Senate. It has a greater chance of passage now that Democrats hold a majority. Hoyer reintroduced the legislation in May, saying, "It's never too late to do the right thing, but this legislation would work to right a historic wrong while ensuring our capital reflects the principles and ideals of what Americans stand for. Each state contributes 2 statues of people of historical importance to be displayed in the Capitol's National Statuary Hall, ranging from Revolutionary War hero Ethan Allen from Vermont to disability rights activist Helen Keller from Alabama. Which statues would be removed? The bill calls for the removal of a bust of former Supreme Court Chief Justice Roger Taney, who wrote the Dred Scott decision in 1857, which declared enslaved people were not citizens and did not have the right to sue. Why should they occupy a place of honor and reverence in this building? Said Representative Jamie Raskin, a Democrat from Maryland, who noted that Taney's hometown of Frederick, Maryland, removed the statue of its native son 5 years ago. In the name of original intent, Justice Taney transformed our Constitution into a white man's compact, Raskin said. He disgraced the Supreme Court. It would take the Civil War, the Reconstruction Amendments, and the Civil Rights Movement to dismantle the white supremacist Constitution. Taney's bust, which sits inside the old Supreme Court chamber in the Capitol, would be replaced with one of Thurgood Marshall, the first African-American Supreme Court justice. Representative Glenn Grothman, Republican from Wisconsin, said he opposed the bill because of Marshall's support for Roe v. Wade, the decision that legalized abortion in 1973. I will always look at him as the guy who kind of put the foot on the gas and legalized late-term abortion, he said. The bill would remove the statues of former Vice President John Calhoun, North Carolina Governor Charles Aycock, and Arkansas Senator John Clark, whom the legislation identifies as playing a major role in defending slavery and segregation. If the statues were provided by a state, for example, Calhoun was provided by South Carolina, the architect of the Capitol, the office tasked with preserving the Capitol would send them back. States would be allowed to replace statues. What we should do today is regulate these statues to the dustbin of history, said Representative James Clyburn, Democrat from South Carolina. Any bust or statue that is removed and not owned by a state would be left up to the architect of the Capitol to address. More than 90 Confederate monuments were taken down or moved from public spaces in 2020, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center. Nearly 800 Confederate monuments were in the USA at the beginning of 2020, a number that dwindled to about 700 by the end of last year. History of Confederate statues. Like other symbols of the Confederacy, such memorials have been defended for generations as pieces of Southern heritage or artifacts of history. But for many people, they are reminders of racial discrimination and violent oppression that has never gone away. Hoyer said Tuesday the legislation is to dishonor hate. We cannot forget that we had hate. We cannot forget that segregation and slavery existed, nor should we. But we ought not to honor those who pursued those efforts, particularly during the Civil War and leading up to the Civil War, he said. We can't change history, but we can certainly make it clear that which we honor and that which we do not honor. Symbols of slavery, sedition, and segregation have no place in the halls of Congress. The Capitol has 10 Confederate statues, a few of which already are in the process of being removed and replaced by the states that sent them. The statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee that stood in the U.S. Capitol on behalf of the state of Virginia for 111 years was removed and taken to a museum in Richmond in December per the request of state leaders. In 2020, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, a Democrat from California, ordered the removal of 4 portraits in the U.S. Capitol of former House speakers who served in the Confederacy. Many protesters and activists have demanded the removal of Confederate statues across the country and the renaming of military bases honoring Confederate military leaders. Representative Barry Loudermilk, Republican from Georgia, said he disagreed with the process in which the legislation was brought forward and how it would remove the statues. My opposition to this bill isn't because of the goal that we're trying to achieve, but it's the way that the majority continues to skirt procedure in this body for the second consecutive Congress, Loudermilk said. Other Republicans, including former President Donald Trump, have vehemently denounced the changes. Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican from Kentucky, said in 2020, "What I do think is clearly a bridge too far is this nonsense that we need to airbrush the Capitol and scrub out everybody from years ago who had any connection to slavery." The Senate overwhelmingly passed a defense bill last July that included removal of Confederate names from military bases. Savannah Berman and Ledyard King also write hard work challenges lie ahead in the Senate. Celebration short for 8-year, $1.2 trillion infrastructure deal. When a group of Democratic and Republican senators assembled at the White House on Thursday with President Joe Biden to announce an infrastructure deal, it was all smiles and celebration. Today is proof that bipartisanship is alive and well in the United States Senate and in our country, Arizona Senator Kristen Sinema, the lead Democratic negotiator, said at the Capitol. The celebration over the 8-year, $1.2 trillion deal lasted only a few hours. Despite the marathon negotiations that led to the compromise, the hardest work lies ahead, cobbling together a coalition of liberals, Democratic moderates, and perhaps Republican centrists to pass the traditional transportation funding bill while pushing a human infrastructure program that touches subsidized childcare, home caregiving, and climate change that only Democrats support. Evidence of how complicated that will be was clear when Biden declared at the news conference that he wouldn't sign the bipartisan proposal without the human infrastructure elements, only to carefully walk back those comments Saturday after some Republicans hinted at backing out. The back and forth signals just how fragile the infrastructure deal is in Congress, where Democrats control both chambers by whisker-thin margins. Over the next few weeks, Democrats will craft a budget proposal that will need to please liberals and moderates within their party if they hope to pass a separate bill with Biden's priorities using a legislative maneuver called reconciliation. Getting those things passed in Congress requires the backing of liberals and the support of at least 10 Republicans in the Senate, except when the party in control uses reconciliation, which allows budget-related bills to get a floor vote without needing 60 votes to overcome a filibuster. The Senate is split 50-50, and Vice President Kamala Harris can break tie votes. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Democrat from California, and Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York, said Congress would not vote on the bipartisan infrastructure bill until the Senate passes its budget bill and sends it to the House in July. The reconciliation package does not exist publicly yet, but a large proposal has been floated by Senator Bernie Sanders, the Vermont Independent and Liberal firebrand, who has ramped up pressure on Biden to go bigger on social programs. Sanders, who chairs the Senate Budget Committee, has a $6 trillion plan that would incorporate what Republicans derided as a liberal wish list, dropping the age for Medicare eligibility from 65 to 60, providing robust preschool and elder care program funding, expanding government-supported health care coverage for hearing, dental, and vision, and huge climate provisions, said Representative Ro Khanna, Democrat from California, who has seen an outline of the plan. It is imperative that at this moment in American history, we begin to address the long-neglected problems facing working-class people, in addition, of course, to physical infrastructure, in addition to climate, Sanders told USA Today last week. Add all that stuff up. It's an expensive proposition, but I think we have very strong support. Sanders said the price tag of his proposal would decrease, particularly if the bipartisan deal addresses traditional infrastructure that no longer would need to be included in his plan. Bill will get a lot of work. Both Democratic majorities in Congress have pursued a two-track plan for weeks, the bipartisan deal on one track and the larger bill on the reconciliation track. We can't get the bipartisan bill done unless we are sure we're getting the budget reconciliation bill done. We can't get the budget reconciliation bill done unless we're sure of the bipartisan, Schumer said last week. Liberal leaders are not worried that Biden's walk back Saturday will complicate their efforts to move ahead with both bills. Speaker Pelosi knows the votes aren't there to pass the bipartisan bill unless the House votes simultaneously on a Senate-passed reconciliation measure with bold climate provisions, Khanna told USA Today on Monday. So Biden's statements are not as relevant as the hard count. Senate Democratic moderates who helped to negotiate the bipartisan deal harbor reservations about a reconciliation bill, especially one as big as Sanders proposed. Senator John Tester, Democrat from Montana, called it plenty hefty. And Senator Jeanne Shaheen, Democrat from New Hampshire, shook her head when USA Today asked about the $6 trillion price tag. I think it will get a lot of work. If they think in reconciliation, I'm going to throw caution to the wind and go to 5 trillion or 6 trillion when we can only afford 1 or 1.5 trillion or maybe 2 trillion, then I can't be there. Senator Joe Manchin, a Democrat from West Virginia, told US ABC News this week. Senator Alex Padilla, a Democrat from California, called the price tag ambitious. Let's look at the flip side at how we pay for it, starting with the most wealthy Americans and multinational corporations, he said. Sanders' proposal does not spell out how it would be paid for, a task that will be left to Senator Ron Wyden, a Democrat from Oregon, and other members of the Senate Finance Committee he chairs. Liberals have pitched ideas such as ending hundreds of billions in federal subsidies annually provided to the fossil fuel industry and raising the corporate tax rate that was cut from 35% to 21% under the Trump administration's tax cuts in 2017. On whether he would support raising the corporate tax rate back to 35%, Padilla told USA Today, maybe not all the way to 35%, but up from where they are, absolutely. What will ultimately pass is a bill that both Sanders and Manchin can agree on, since the Democrats cannot afford to lose a single vote. Though Sanders' initial proposal is unlikely to make it to the House, a number of Senate Democrats, such as Bob Casey of Pennsylvania, told USA Today that they're open at least to discussion. All I know is we have to go big, whatever the definition of big ends up being, he said. We have to have a blood oath about Part 2 reconciliation bill. Republicans opposed. Some Republican senators who have backed the infrastructure deal expressed hesitancy after Biden threatened he would sign it into law only if Congress passed a reconciliation bill. Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, one of 11 Republican senators who negotiated with the White House and endorsed the bipartisan bill, called Biden's comments extortion. Senator Mike Braun, Republican from Indiana, said any compromise on pay-for infrastructure is a bad deal so long as Biden, Pelosi, and Schumer insist on pursuing multi-trillion dollar tax and spend reconciliation packages. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican from Kentucky, insisted in a statement Monday that Biden needs to request that Schumer and Pelosi disconnect the bipartisan bill from the reconciliation package, saying Democrats want to hold a bipartisan bill hostage over a separate and partisan process. Unless Leader Schumer and Speaker Pelosi walk back their threats, McConnell said, then President Biden's walk back of his veto threat would be a hollow gesture. Continuing in politics, Ella Lee for the USA Today writes, examining reconciliation process, delay of deal on wider plan. Amid talks of compromise on a bipartisan infrastructure deal, some Democrats say they won't fall in line without the promise of another piece of legislation on President Joe Biden's desk. There won't be an infrastructure bill unless we have a reconciliation bill. Plain and simple, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said Thursday, threatening to withhold a House vote on the deal until the Senate sends the president a bill focused on human infrastructure, too. In the case of this bill, reconciliation isn't synonymous with making peace. Here's a look at what the congressional process of reconciliation entails and why it's making headlines. What is reconciliation? Reconciliation is a special process that essentially makes it easier for legislation to pass the Senate. The process allows for tax, spending, and debt limit bills to be expedited by sidestepping typical congressional holdups. The reconciliation process can be undertaken only if the House and Senate agree on a budget resolution that includes reconciliation directives for committees first, according to the Nonpartisan Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. The directives instruct the committees to prepare and report legislation by a specified date that does one or a mix of the following, according to the CBPP. Increases or decreases spending by specified amounts over an allotted time, increases or decreases revenue by specified amounts over an allotted time, or modifies the public debt limit. In other words, the directives let legislators know how much room they have to spend more or spend less with each budget. The budget resolutions cannot be filibustered and are not sent to the president to be signed into law. Reconciliation bills bring forth laws that reflect the priorities laid out in the budget resolution. Like budget resolutions, reconciliation bills cannot be filibustered. So instead of needing 60 votes, these bills can be passed by a simple majority. Since the Senate is split 50-50 down party lines and Vice President Kamala Harris holds the tie-breaking vote, reconciliation would allow Senate Democrats to land a tax and spending bill on Biden's desk without any Republican support. How long has it been used, or how has it been used? Reconciliation was established in the Congressional Budget and Impoundment Control Act of 1974. Since 1980, when the process was first used, Congress has sent 26 reconciliation bills to the president. 22 measures were enacted and 4 were vetoed, according to a Congressional Research Service report. Most recently, the reconciliation was used to pass Republicans' tax plan in 2017 and this year's American Rescue Plan Act, the $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief package. In its first years of use, the process primarily approved spending cuts, but shortly after, bills came to include seemingly irrelevant policies. For example, one Reconciliation Act reduced the number of members of the Federal Communications Commission and the Interstate Commerce Commission, according to the CRS report. The late Senator Robert Byrd, a Democrat from West Virginia, viewed these deviations as abuses of power. He proposed a rule to curb the practice of including extraneous provisions in reconciliation bills. We are in the process now of seeing the Pandora's box, which has been opened to the abuse of reconciliation process, Byrd said when proposing the rule. If the budget reform process is going to be preserved, and more importantly, if we are going to preserve the deliberative process in this U.S. Senate, which is the outstanding, unique element with respect to the U.S. Senate, action must be taken now to stop this abuse of the budget process. The rule, dubbed the Byrd Rule, was codified in the Congressional Budget Act of 1974 in 1990, according to the CRS report. Why is it relevant? The bipartisan infrastructure package is teetering on the brink of potential collapse, and whether it will has to do mostly with whether a reconciliation bill will be tied to its passage. In his remarks, announcing that he and a bipartisan group of 21 senators reached a would-be deal on infrastructure, Biden indicated he wouldn't sign the package without a reconciliation bill addressing human infrastructure also on his desk. If they don't both come, I'm not signing it. Real simple, Biden said. Republicans said the comments blindsided them, throwing the infrastructure compromise into question. Biden later walked back that statement, saying that it was not his intent to threaten a veto on the infrastructure package. The bottom line is this. I gave my word to support the infrastructure plan. That's what I intend to do, he said. But progressives aren't impressed, and without them, the infrastructure bill remains in murky waters. Let me be clear. There will not be a bipartisan infrastructure deal without a reconciliation bill that substantially improves the lives of working families and combats the existential threat of climate change, Senator Bernie Sanders, the independent from Vermont, tweeted on Sunday. Now let's turn to the opinion section from the Des Moines Register. Our first guest columnist for your turn is Janet Peterson. She writes, "Birthdays shouldn't rule out justice." In an episode of This Is Us, the show depicts a scene of a woman in labor in a 1960s delivery room. The camera toggles between the woman struggling through the final minutes of labor and the wall clock above her. The baby's birthday is about to be determined, before midnight or after. Just 2 minutes before midnight, the baby is born. Earlier in the same episode, two young brothers are sitting at a bar watching television intensely as the Selective Service draft lottery pulls the birthday of one of the young men, the baby born in the other scene. That birthday, right before midnight, got assigned a single-digit draft number, which sent the young man to Vietnam and changed the trajectory of his life. Birthdays are used for all sorts of things: eligibility for preschool and kindergarten, learner's permits, driver's licenses, voting age, drinking age, marriage licenses, Social Security, Medicare, running for public office, and even legal consent to sex. Sometimes using birthdays for public policy makes sense, but not when it comes to child sex abuse. Attorney General Tom Miller recently released the findings of his investigation into child sex abuse in the Catholic Church, which represents just a small fraction of sexual abuse cases in Iowa. The report revealed child sex abuse was pervasive, with more than 100 clergy credibly accused in the 4 Iowa Catholic dioceses. The institution participated in decades of cover-ups, ignoring multiple allegations, providing predators financial assistance and identity cover, and even transferring known serial sexual predators to unsuspecting communities to abuse more innocent children. Despite Iowa's new law eliminating criminal statute of limitations for child sex abuse, these Roman Catholic priests who drugged and raped Iowa children and the diocese that covered up the crime are immune from criminal prosecution in every case. Iowa's new law is still based on the victim's birthday for Iowans who turned 33 before the bill was signed into law. It doesn't apply to cases where the statute of limitations has already expired, even with overwhelming evidence to prosecute other than DNA evidence. This is wrong. No child rapist should get a free pass to live among us, continue serving communion, and be in places where it is easy to groom and abuse more innocent children. Organizations that covered up these horrific crimes against our children shouldn't be immune from punishment either. It is time to open the window to justice to give survivors their day in court, no matter when they were born. Other states have done it. The Hidden Predator Act, Senate File 32, eliminates Iowa's archaic civil statute of limitations and opens a window of time for those who never got a chance at justice to have their day in court. The Senate Judiciary Committee unanimously passed a similar bill last session that got rid of both the civil and criminal statute of limitations and opened the window to justice for adult survivors. But Senate Majority Leader Jack Whitaker killed the bill by not bringing it up for debate on the Senate floor, despite pleas from several Iowa sex abuse survivors. In Iowa, most survivors of child rape are barred from seeking civil damages when they turn 19 years old. It's even worse if the predator was a school employee, therapist, or counselor. Those professionals, who should be the most trusted adults in a kid's life, are protected under a loophole that shuts off justice 5 years after the child leaves the school or ends therapy. Personnel at Iowa's new unregulated charter schools will also get this protection. Iowans, it's time to rally for our children. We have a chance to fix this when the legislature convenes again, even if it's just for a day later this year to address redistricting. States that have gotten rid of the civil statute of limitations and opened up a window to justice for adult survivors have uncovered serial predators with as many as 1,000 victims. These are not people lurking in bathrooms. Most often they are the people you know and trust with your kids, their doctors, coaches, teachers, and relatives. Telling Iowans that serial child rapists can live among us free as birds with access to our kids because their rape victims couldn't press charges against them based on their birthday is nuts. But that was the law. We are stuck with the outcome unless we give these survivors a civil remedy. Until this law passes, child abuse sexual predators will continue harming our children. It is time for the Attorney General, the Governor, and the Republican lawmakers to quit being complicit, step up, and rally behind our children. We cannot afford to be known as a state that protects predators and organizations that allowed these monsters to destroy people's lives. Janet Peterson is a Democratic state senator who's served Senate District 18 in Western Des Moines. In letters to the editor today, our first letter comes from Janet Johnston of Des Moines. Defer maintenance, court disaster. The Miami condo collapse doesn't surprise me. There will be more, particularly in high-rise vacation condos close to the beach. My husband and I owned a Maui beachfront condo in an 80-unit complex. We were literally within a stone's throw of the beach. Only 6 units, including ours, were owner-occupied. The rest were investments or vacation rentals. Some owners never darkened the door for years. Their goal? Maximize income, minimize expense. Consequently, they voted against or to delay all recommended maintenance projects, particularly if, God forbid, they required a special assessment. The outcome of such greed and neglect of necessary maintenance is entirely predictable. After a few years of watching this, we sold our unit and got out. From Greg Becker of Council Bluffs, we need troopers on Iowa highways. Really? I thought that the control of our national borders was the responsibility of the federal government. I could understand why southern states are asking for help. However, it seems that there are party overtones in law enforcement being sent to the border and that the help should be provided at the federal level, not the state. I have seen hardly any troopers on our interstate and rural highways. I drive those roads enough during peak hours and know that the staffing is not what it should be. Now the governor decides to send our troopers to another state. And finally, from Floyd Gardner of Altoona, the political process produces good things too. Obamacare seems to be in the limelight lately. The Supreme Court's latest decision to once again allow the act in its entirety is clear evidence of its importance in people's lives. Some Republicans are unwilling to accept the Affordable Care Act as a fact. An example is the opinion column June 27th by Mark Tyson, "Obamacare shows big government won't be undone." Tyson continues to condemn the act as a purely political product, ignoring the benefits it provides to citizens. Tyson is correct in accusing the act of being born in politics. The Affordable Care Act is a product of our nation's legislature, and as such, it's obviously subject to politics and political maneuvers. There's nothing wrong with that. Politics is also the driving force behind Social Security, Medicare, the 40-hour work week, and myriad other popular benefits that provide comfort and safety to the average American citizen. In the United States, we use our government to our benefit. The column cites big government in a condemning way. We need to be less concerned with the size of government and more concerned with what the government does. In this case, our government, regardless of its size, did the right thing. As a result, millions of Americans who otherwise would not have access to health care now receive coverage. All three branches of our government came together to make that happen. Most Americans are grateful for a political process that produces such benefits. Tyson's criticism is simply stubborn and wrong-headed. Our second year-turn guest columnist is Mike Ralston, and he writes, "Biden's planned higher taxes would hurt Iowa businesses." Iowa, like the nation as a whole, is seeing its economy rebound as the pandemic moves toward an end. But massive tax increases proposed by the Biden administration threaten to derail the recovery, hurting Iowa job creators and families. The president's recent budget proposal includes $3.6 trillion in tax hikes. The administration claims that the tax increases will hit only big corporations and the rich, but the truth is the proposed tax increases will be paid for by workers and families through lost jobs and lower wages. This will impact thousands of small businesses. Take the proposal to raise the corporate tax rate from 21% to 28%, which the administration wants you to believe will affect only big business. The reality is it would hurt businesses of all sizes, their employees and consumers. For example, if the corporate tax rate were increased to 28%, Iowa companies would face a combined state and federal rate of 35.1%, more than 10 percentage points higher than China, making it harder for Iowa manufacturers to compete with foreign companies. On top of that, under the president's budget proposal, companies headquartered in Iowa would face higher U.S. taxes on global income. In total, this tax increase would hit 18,498 Iowa employers, including 12,786 small businesses with fewer than 500 employees. Many of these businesses are just now beginning to get back on their feet. Sudden and substantial tax hikes are one sure way to stop their recovery's momentum dead in its tracks. Experience shows that the damage from higher corporate tax rates will be borne overwhelmingly by workers who will see lower wages and fewer jobs. And all Iowans, as consumers, can expect to see higher prices and even higher utility bills as companies are forced to pass along the cost of these increased taxes. Keep in mind, Joe Biden's proposed tax hikes are not just on businesses. They also threaten investment in Iowa startups and growing businesses. The Biden plan essentially doubles the tax rate on capital gains, hitting approximately two-thirds of capital investment in the United States. For some Iowa investors, the combined state and federal tax rate would exceed 50%. If you're saving for retirement, to buy a home, or for your kids' college education, you will feel the pinch. Adding further to the burden, the president's proposal would levy a much higher tax burden on the transfer of assets of family-owned businesses at death. This would threaten the ability of the next generation of Iowans to keep those family-owned grocery stores, restaurants, auto body shops, construction companies, and farms up and running. The bottom line is that raising taxes now will stop the recovery dead in its tracks. These tax increases aren't pro-growth or pro-job policy. They aren't part of the recipe for recovery, and they must be stopped. Hardworking Iowans and Americans deserve better. I encourage my fellow Iowans to join me in contacting the representatives and telling them not to raise taxes that will hurt small businesses, workers, and families. Mike Ralston was elected as president of the Iowa Association of Business and Industry in 2005, Ralston was appointed by Governor Tom Vilsack and served almost 3 years as Iowa Department of Revenue Director. And now looking at the opinion page of the USA Today, Jill Lawrence, the commentary editor for the USA Today, writes, "Now can we get serious about infrastructure? Florida condo tragedy is a wake-up call. Infrastructure is a joke, a bore, a long-running public policy frustration. This past week, it has been an unimaginable tragedy and a reminder that we never have as much time as we think in our lives, with our families, and in our political life, where so much time is spent scoring points instead of making sure the nation is safe and thriving. It was an accident of fate that the bipartisan infrastructure deal long sought by President Joe Biden came to fruition on the same day that a 12-story condo building partially collapsed in Surfside, Florida, claiming what surely will be scores of lives and destroying countless others. It is not clear what caused the catastrophic failure, but building experts are weighing climate change impact as a possible factor, including rising tides, flooding, corrosion, cracked concrete, a sinking tower, 40-year-old building standards inadequate to current challenges, and a 2018 report that found problems but did not spark the proper urgency. Repairs were finally about to begin nearly 3 years later. American failures. A major investment in infrastructure has been the supposed holy grail all across the political spectrum far more than a decade. Somehow, between arguments over how to pay for it and interruptions like the COVID-19 pandemic, we have never done what is necessary to be or even act like the first world country we are certain we are. We pay little mind to the engineering report cards that consistently give America's infrastructure terrible to mediocre grades. We ignore the gleaming foreign airports and subways, the childcare and healthcare infrastructure in other countries that get this done instead of joking and fighting and putting off action. The collapse of an interstate bridge in Minneapolis drew headlines in 2007, but our attention span didn't last long. Now we hear the Surfside mayor saying repeatedly that things like this don't happen in America, shouldn't happen in America, that this is a third world event, a third world phenomena, and we are not a third world country. The irony is that people from outside America bought condos in this building thinking it was a secure investment. And why wouldn't they? We regulate construction. We have rules and codes, and most people follow them. We are a symbol of order and reason in the world, or at least we used to be. But we have been fighting a long and severe case of chronic short-termism, now aggravated by an equally severe case of science phobia. Not just fear of science, but active rejection of science. We don't know whether climate change might have played a role in this calamity, but we certainly could be doing more to create community and environmental resilience in the face of this existential problem. We don't yet know how engineering problems or faulty construction or materials contributed, if they did at all, and investigations will take months and possibly years to complete. But maybe we can overcome our short-term outlook and our hostility toward science and each other to pass this bipartisan infrastructure compromise that is so much more than some people want and so much less than many others had hoped. Its focus is traditional infrastructure like bridges and roads, and it is sorely needed. And then, if we're lucky enough to see it becoming law, maybe we will go on to finish the job by making investments in human infrastructure and climate resilience, help for coastal communities. Those would happen later this year in a reconciliation package that requires 51 Senate votes, the exact number Democrats may be able to muster, rather than the unachievable 60 to break a filibuster. The climate investments, part of Biden's initial American Jobs Plan, but largely missing from the bipartisan deal, would make homes, businesses, and landscapes less vulnerable and could help coastal communities like Surfside strengthen their defenses. We should get past the arguments about how exactly to define infrastructure. We should get past the infrastructure week jokes that signal the futility of even trying to make progress. We should get past all of that and look at what our country needs. We should look at the people and companies that have prospered wildly in the last decade, those who can afford to pay higher taxes to underwrite these investments in the greater good. We can make sure we are protected, that constructive, collective action is still possible. Be a real first world nation. More than 7 years ago, like the Surfside mayor, Biden invoked the third world to make a point about our inadequacies. If I took you and blindfolded you and took you to LaGuardia Airport in New York, you must think I must be in some third world country. He said LaGuardia had been renovated, is now being renovated, and is a fitting gateway to a first world country. We should make that happen throughout America. We can and should live up to our image of ourselves. Jill Lawrence is the commentary editor of USA Today and author of The Art of the Political Deal, How Congress Beat the Odds and Broke Through Gridlock. The second op-ed article comes from Representative Chrissy Houlihan, a Democrat from Pennsylvania. She writes, insulting the military helps our enemies. People are watching, but GOP doesn't care. Last week in Washington, General Mark Milley made headlines. With surgical precision, the decorated general and chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff eviscerated untrue and unfounded allegations about critical race theory levied by one of my Republican colleagues. If you have not watched, I encourage you to do so. He reminded people like me, a fellow veteran, why we raise our hands to serve this country, because we believe not only in the Constitution, but also in the people we swore to defend. In his testimony, General Milley also said something that reminded me of what my commanding officer in the Air Force used to say, people are watching. As Republican lawmakers barraged General Milley and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin with highly politicized questions about race, the pair issued that same warning I heard 30 years ago up at Hanscom Air Force Base. People are watching. It's a dire warning that has fallen on deaf ears, I fear. Our enemies are cheering. They weren't referencing the people in the hearing room or those watching Fox News or MSNBC. They weren't talking about the Twitter trolls retweeting content for clout. They meant our enemies. I served in the Air Force as an engineer at the tail end of the Cold War era and Desert Storm. My assignment was anti-ballistic missile defense command and control design. My job was to understand how our enemies thought, predict how they were likely to attack, and then design systems that would help us protect our homeland and allies. What the American people need to understand about our enemies is this. They look for any and every vulnerability. What might start as a small crack in our national security or our nation, a throwaway comment about our military or our military leaders are weak and ineffective, for example, can quickly become a gaping hole. The opportunity to sow and foment discord is in the textbook first step of the divide and conquer strategy. General Milley and Secretary Austin heard what I heard in that hearing, a damaging attempt to politicize the United States military, an attempt that I'm sure was cheered on by our enemies, both foreign and domestic, both state and non-state actors. National security undermined. In just the past 2 weeks, here's what we've heard from leading conservative and Republican voices. Fox News host Tucker Carlson called General Milley a pig who is stupid. Representative Matt Gaetz of Florida openly mocked the sacrifices our armed forces have made in past conflicts. Representative Madison Cawthorn of North Carolina suggested that America look to the Viet Cong for inspiration. And Fox News host Laura Ingraham even floated defunding the military. The irony of someone who has never served suggesting our troops go without pay or go unprotected, the same troops who defend the very right to make such absurd statements or suggestions, is not lost on me. It's not lost on my brother or many cousins who served in the global war on terror. It's not lost on my dad who served in Vietnam. It would not be lost on my grandfather who served in Korea. Those people may think they're making innocuous comments, however hurtful, but General Milley, Secretary Austin, and I know better, and so does anyone who has worn a uniform. My colleagues in Congress are actively undermining our national security, aiding and abetting the enemies we swore to defend Americans against. People are watching. We need to start acting like it. Representative Chrissy Houlihan, a Democrat from Pennsylvania's 6th Congressional District, was an Air Force engineer working on anti-ballistic missile defense command and control design. We have one last news article here from the USA Today, written by John Kennedy. Earlier building collapses prompted stricter standards. Two earlier building collapses in Florida led to stricter engineering and construction standards over the past decades, prompting some lawmakers to urge that a similar overhaul is demanded by the Surfside condominium tragedy. Senator Jason Pizzo, a Democrat from North Miami Beach, said he plans to file legislation that would likely focus on building requirements, reinspection standards for older buildings, the risk of seawater intrusion, and the financial obligations of condominium associations. We should at least be looking at two things: the actual physical structure itself, the design and materials used, and the accelerated environmental conditions that are affecting these buildings near the beach, said Pizzo, whose district includes Surfside and 14 other Miami-Dade County cities, most of them filled with high-rise condos. Florida lawmakers began committee work in September in advance of the 2022 legislative sessions that starts in January. While Pizzo's ideas haven't drawn much attention yet, Florida has a history of disaster followed by a response. When the Federal Drug Enforcement Agency's building in downtown Miami collapsed in 1974, killing seven people, the almost 50-year-old building's failure was blamed on an overloaded parking deck. But it led to a recertification inspection program for commercial and residential buildings more than 40 years old. The program only was used in Miami-Dade for decades until Broward County began such recertification inspections in 2006. The Champlain Towers South condominium had begun its 40-year recertification process when it fell last Thursday. "We have to have recertification statewide, especially in coastal areas," Pizzo said. Another notable collapse, the five-story Harbor K condominium, which gave way during construction in 1981, killing 11 workers, was blamed on engineering and design flaws. That led to more expansive inspection requirements for Florida's buildings three stories and taller. The Harbor K collapse occurred the same year the Champlain Towers in Surfside were being built. On Tuesday, search teams continued to work through the debris as the death toll stood at 11, with 150 people still missing. President Joe Biden and First Lady Jill Biden are scheduled to visit the area on Thursday. Representative Joe Gellert, a Democrat from Aventura, who also represents Surfside, said that it is likely that any effort to expand state building, engineering, or inspection requirements will face resistance, especially from a Republican-controlled legislature that tends to side with industry. Still, he pointed out that Floridians living in coastal condos across the state span party lines. Many, Geller said, have become nervous about the integrity of their own buildings and are looking for reassurance since the Surfside disaster. "There will be resistance," Geller said, "but if anything ever is going to get done, it better be done now." So far, though, Governor Ron DeSantis has taken a longer view of the disaster. He said it was important to review eventual findings by the National Institute of Standards and Technology, part of the U.S. Commerce Department, before recommending the next steps. The federal agency, which has investigated four major deadly events in the past 20 years, including the 2001 collapse of the World Trade Center, Twin Towers, has joined the structural review now being conducted by Surfside and Miami-Dade County officials. "It is something that's going to be very thorough and is something that is not going to happen in a day or two," he added. "I think the people of Florida want to understand how this could happen and what could we do to make sure that it does not happen again." And that's it for our second hour of The Register on Iris. We're so glad to have you listening. I'm your reader, Lisa Horsch. Coming up next, obituaries from the Des Moines Register.